This land is your land.
Good evening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm Carol Murphy. Thank you so much for once again listening in. And we have a guest that I think you'll really enjoy this evening. Stella, say your last name for me again. I practiced it.
Kaposia.
I don't want to mess it up.
Sorry.
Stella Kaposia is here. And in just a moment, she's going to come back and tell us all about her. And one of the things that made me really want to interview Stella is the work that she's doing. She's a PhD professor here at Montana Tech, and she's been doing some work locally and won an award for it. So Stella will be back in just a moment and introduce herself. This is Heartstock Radio. I'm Carol Murphy. Thank you so much for listening.
I roamed and ran, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of a diamond dance. And all around me, a voice was sounding. This land was made for you and
good evening, and thanks again for listening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm Carol Murphy. Tonight, our guest is Stella Kaposia, and that's a good Italian name.
Most people can't pronounce it. I feel like, you know, just don't call me cappuccino and we're good.
Yeah, I was actually going to pronounce it similar to that, so I'm glad. Glad I stopped myself. Okay, Stella, please tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Well, I've been in Butte for almost 9 years, and this will be coming up on 11 years in Montana. I am an associate professor at Montana Tech in the Department of Biological Sciences, and my area specialty is human dimensions of wildlife, or human dimensions of animals.
What does that mean exactly?
So it puts a lens of, it looks at the human-animal relationship, and it puts that lens of how the human interest influences the way in which animals are dispersed on the landscape. So if you look at something like the bison issue or the bison population in Yellowstone, they have a carrying capacity that's really more of a social carrying capacity. So it's not entirely ecosystem-based, or it could be, if you could reconceptualize it as ecosystem-based, looking at humans as part of that ecosystem and our tolerance levels. So what animals we like, what animals we don't like, where they are, what our relationship to them is, how that forms boundaries, how those associations translate into all sorts of different issues.
So when you say carrying capacity, that is essentially just how many buffalo can the people in the land tolerate?
Right. And carrying capacity, most people think about it as the most amount of animals or species, individuals that an area can sustain, but you really want to think about it over time. So the maximum number of individuals that an area can sustain over time. And so that natural carrying capacity is going to have dips and rises, and those are going to be triggered by environmental conditions like a harsh winter or predation. They might also be triggered by hunting season or, again, social tolerance. And it just depends on whether or not you look at humans as part of the environment.
So the work that you're doing, we're going to get to that in relation to waterfowl and the Berkeley Pit is very important for our community. But I think there's a bigger and a broader picture that translates to how we see wildlife and the natural environment and how it interacts with us from an economic standpoint. And we're going to get to that in just a moment. But first, what I was hoping you would share with our listeners is a little bit more about you and what your inspiration was to go into this line of work. Maybe, you know, when was the first time you thought about doing this and what influenced you?
Well, Carol, that has two separate answers. When did I think about working with animals and in the field of science? And I'd say pretty much from the day I could stuff worms and crickets into my pockets and bring them home, much to my parents' dismay. If I gave you the list of animals that my parents have had to deal with over the last, well, you know, I haven't lived with them in 23 years, but in growing up, you know, they have, I've actually been called out of high school to help the police officer catch a swan. And I thought he'd raided my car, you know, and found the six pack of Bud Light that was back there. But actually he needed to, he needed my expert help at 15 years, 16 years old to help wrangle a swan in someone's backyard.
How to catch a swan in 15 minutes.
Exactly. I also learned at that point that he couldn't drive a stick shift. So two strikes against the police officer in Barrington, Rhode Island, and two strikes for me, and that are, you know, two checks in my box there. But when did I have an intellectual shift is sort of a different question. So I've always been I've always been affiliated with animals, both wildlife and domestic, and literally from the time I was a year and a half, 2 years old. But I was on San Salvador in the Bahamas and for a tropical ecology course with Lake Erie College, which is my undergrad. And we had spent an amazing week to 10 days looking at coral reefs and the ecology there, and we'd done some history. And we were out diving in a place, I believe it was called Oyster Bay, and there were a couple of fishermen out there. And some of us had jumped up on the dock, and some of us were still snorkeling out in the reef, and they seemed incredibly alarmed and asked where a couple of us were and jumped in their boats and rowed like mad, pulled the two people that were still out there on the boat and came back in. They said, oh, the hammerheads are coming in because we've been spearfishing. And sure enough, the sharks came in. It was a very electric moment for everybody, you know, near-death experience as far as anybody was concerned. And out of their boat, they pulled a hawksbill turtle. And they had harvested the turtle, and they were in the process of butchering it. And I really became irate that, you know, here we were watching this sea turtle be butchered, and everything we thought about for the last week to 10 days was conservation and protection. And my professor, Dr. Belanger, pulled me aside and he said, you know, these guys went out without a motor. They don't have electricity. They are eating off the land. They have exactly no food miles, and you're going to get back on your jet engine plane with your rolls of film and the beer that you're drinking at night and the food that's wrapped up in plastic, and you have a much bigger impact than that one turtle. And it was just blew my mind, total mind shift of what my impact was and the way that we think about a relationship to the environment and ecology and what we think about in terms of use and sustainability and where protection, the weight of protection falls. You know, so a policy to protect sea turtles isn't going to affect me in any way other than to know the sea turtles there. And I want the turtles there. I want to live in a world where the turtles are there, whether or not I get to see them. But on a day-to-day, it affects those people that are far more sustainable than I am.
So you spent some time in Africa also?
I did. And I almost had the exact same lesson on a grander scale. I was in the Peace Corps first. So I lived in East Africa and Kenya for 2.5 years. And one of the things that became glaring to me was I was the only one in the community that produced trash. Everybody else, there was no trash at all. Everything they ate from their farms, and they would carry home in reusable bags that they had woven themselves. And I had plastic wrap and cheese wrappers and peanut butter jars and all of this just piling up in my house. There was no waste system because there wasn't a need for it. And I was like, wait a minute. Yeah. Let me take a look and what kind of footprint I'm having.
Yeah, and I noticed that in Indonesia a lot, talking to folks that have been there since the 70s and how they've seen the accumulations of plastics. Very, very challenging. And it's a good lesson to go and see just how much trash we generate when there is no system to really accommodate it or deal with it. And that's how it's all ending up in the ocean.
Yeah, we don't have to think about it here. You know, that we put it in a barrel and then somebody comes and takes it away. What would we do if we didn't have to, mm-hmm. you know, if we had to deal with our own
Yep.
Waste.
Every individual. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the word sustainability or sustainable. Can you give us your definition of what that means?
You said you didn't want one word answers. My first thought is nope.
Well, you don't have to. We can find another question that you like better.
No, it's an interesting challenge because there's so many different ways to think about sustainability. There's the cradle to grave concept. There's also the cradle to cradle concept. On one side, sustainability I think denotes the ability for long-term use. And the other side, I back off a little bit because I think that sustainability indicates the lack of change, that one of the things that humans don't like is change. We try to keep things exactly the same, yet we are one of the most significant impacts on ecosystem function, but we don't like change. And so sustainability is to keep things exactly as they are. And so thinking about how are we going to embrace the resources that we use or embrace the use of the resources in a way that really does go long-term into the future, but also maybe is adaptive.
It's dynamic. I like that. Mm-hmm. Very good. So your recent award, tell us a little bit about what exactly was that award and what were you given it for?
Well, so it's from the Montana chapter of the Wildlife Society. It's the Conservation Award. And I have to do two shout-outs. First, last year's, or the award for the year before, went out to Mike Schwitters. He is a lifetime naturalist and conservationist working with migratory waterfowl up in the freeze-out area. And I kid around, but also firmly believe that this year the award had to go out to two people because Mike has made such an impact in our knowledge of waterfowl that not one single person could fill his shoes. So my second shout out goes to my colleague and good friend, Gary Swant, who is a naturalist in this area. He competes for the position of Montana's number one birder. He competes for that position with his grandson. So it's both a joy and a frustration when the two of them switch positions and Gary has to take the number two slot.
So this is basically determined by the number of different species spotted.
Yes, correct? His ability to identify a given number of species. And so Gary and I were really fortunate enough to be given this award from the Wildlife Society for the work that we've been doing with Montana Resources to help understand the dynamics that are going on with migratory waterfowl and the Berkeley Pit.
So I'd like to get into the meat of that. Can you give our listeners who maybe are not from Butte and aren't familiar with our history with the snow geese, can you just tell them a little bit about why it was so important that you do this work and what happened?
Sure. So with any area that we'll call an environmental sacrifice zone, you want to think about all the other factors that environmental sacrifice zone impacts. And one of the big things, whether it's an airport, development area, mining area, is an environmental impact, and not necessarily the formal one, but what kind of impact this activity has on the area environment. And wildlife management comes into that. So with any of these big plans, your big scale industries, you're going to have some kind of wildlife mitigation. And so for the Berkeley Pit, it's specifically for migratory waterfowl.
Because?
It's a large pit lake. And one of the problems is that so the pit was created in response to copper prices that had skyrocketed. And so they dug into the earth looking for copper. And if anybody's driven a car, worn braces, or spoken on a landline, they've benefited from the copper that's come out of the Berkeley Pit. So that's sort of the full circle back to that sea turtle there. But originally, they dewatered the pit. The way the pit was created went deep enough into the water table. And so they actually pulled the water out in order to continue mining operations. And when the prices of copper fell, it's a very short version of the longer story, they stopped dewatering. And so the pit started to fill up with water. And originally, migratory waterfowl, Butte is not a hot spot for migratory waterfowl. We're tucked in the mountains. And so in order to get over to this Butte area, birds have to really kind of pull themselves up over the edge of the Rockies. And when they're migrating from the Arctic down to California, they're looking for they're jumping on the airstream. They're not coming over the Rockies. And then if you look around Butte, there aren't a lot of open water sources. So it just isn't a natural place for birds to go. And so for the first 20 or so years or 10 years, there wasn't a need to have a wildlife or waterfowl mitigation plan because there were no waterfowl. And then one day there were. And so it caught MR by surprise, and they developed a mitigation plan right away. And that worked for 20 years until November 2016, when a variety of factors, like any natural disaster, came into play and challenged the mitigation plan that was in place. And we see the same type of thing with hurricanes, with major storms, with fires, that, you know, planning for the extreme is... We tend to plan for the chronic events and not the acute ones. Yeah. So,
we're going to take a very brief music break here, and Stella will be back and tell us a little bit more about the mitigation plan, what exactly that is. And we're going to talk a little bit about the incidents that kind of spurred all of this work a little more, too. Thanks for listening. This is Heartstock.
This land was made for you and me. Oh, when the sun came shining and I was strolling and the wheat fields waving and the dust clouds rolling, as the fog was lifting, our voice was chanting, this land was made for you and me. And as I went walking, I saw a sign there, and on the sign it said no trespassing, but on the other side it didn't say nothing. That sign was made for you and me. In the shadow of the steeple, I saw my people. By the early forfeits, I see my people. As they stood there hungry, I stood there asking, is this land made for you and me? Or nobody
for tuning in. This is Heartstock Radio. I'm Carol Murphy, and our guest this evening is Stella Kaposha, and she's talking all about waterfowl landing in the Berkeley Pit. What exactly happened that resulted in, you know, somebody picking up the phone and saying, hey, Stella, can you help us with this?
Well, so as many people in Butte know, in late November of 2016, roughly, well, it's an estimated between 60 and 100,000 light geese landed in the pit. And light geese are a mixed flock of snow and Ross's geese. Oftentimes they're just called snow geese because they're referred to as the dominant species, but there are some Ross's in there. So 60,000 to 100,000 birds landed in the pit, and approximately 3,000 of them died there.
Were they lost?
You know, I'm not a bird, so I don't know. It is not a traditional migratory, it's not part of the traditional migratory path, but with, you know, if you have all the mainstream migration, you'll get some dispersal on either side, or distribution on either side. So there are we have some strong hypotheses of what happened. There are three things that trigger migration. It's three major things. There's temperature, day length, and food availability. And so if it's warm and there's food, animals generally aren't going to move. This is why bears in the south are less likely to hibernate than bears in the north. They're still warm and they can still forage. So in 2016, the weather in Canada was warmer than usual. These birds are granivores, so they're foraging on the barley fields. There had been a wet snow, and so that snow had flattened all the grain. And so there were reports that were high numbers of light geese that were lingering in the fields. They couldn't harvest the grain, so these birds were sitting there harvesting it, really building up that body condition. Migration is incredibly hard on birds, 600,000 miles at a time. And so the more calories they can have in them at the time, the better off they are. So they're going to build and build. The other thing about fall is that a lot of the birds are new. They're young of the year, and they've never made this trip before. You know, with spring migration, you know that everybody's already done the trip once. Not so with fall. So they're staying longer than they should, and this cold front kind of swept south of them, and not like a flash freeze, but it had been colder down south than for a little bit of time than it was in the north, and so it froze a lot of the standard migratory stopovers. We call them staging areas. So like Freeze Out Lake, if you're not familiar with it, it's up in the Shoto area. It's absolutely spectacular. The prairie crashes into the Rocky Mountains, and there's birds everywhere, and it's just amazing. I think they stopped there for the view, but they stopped there for the water sources. So that was frozen. So they leave later than normal. They're about a week, week and a half late. And you guys know from Montana, that can really make a big difference with weather. They're flying south. Freeze Out Lake is frozen. So they have to keep going. These birds are biologically driven to land in open water. They don't traditionally land in the fields. So they keep going. They hit this region, and there's what we call a low ceiling. There was a storm here. And clouds are very heavy. They're water vapor, and so they're incredibly hard to fly through. So it literally pushes these birds out of the air. And there, below them, is the Berkeley Pit. And so they have a place to land. They're exhausted. They're being pushed out of the sky, and suddenly this cold front. And one of the nice things about these birds is that because they land in such high flocks, they can really conserve, large flocks, they can really conserve heat. So they flock together. So they really stay together. So once some start landing, the rest start landing, they're all going down. There's a lot of us that think that it doesn't matter what MR did that night and for the next couple of days, they weren't going to get those birds to move because they weren't just fighting against getting the birds up and off the water. They were fighting against thousands of years of evolutionary biology. That these birds were in a safe place, they were huddled together, and they weren't going unless everybody else went. And they're exhausted. So that's the thought of what happened that night, that, you know, it was essentially the perfect storm. Mm. And in terms of survivability, when you think about the percentage of mortalities, 3,000 seems like a lot in numbers, but 3,000 out of somewhere between 60,000 and 100,000, the pit is not the way you want the birds to go, but it's not a substantial percentage of the population.
And what in the water killed them? The ones that died?
You know, that's not something that anybody knows definitively. Certainly the pH is acidic. It's about, at the time, it's about as acidic as a cup of coffee. So we can all sit around and have a cup of coffee and make it through our day, probably a little more efficiently, but it's not what we want to drink at the end of a marathon. The pit also has dissolved metals in it, and those concentrations and composition of dissolved metals changes from time to time. In fact, the pH has been improving. So now the pH is at about, I believe it's about 4.1.
So what is your plan and what is the plan for the future? How did you come up with it?
So there's not a clear plan for the future in terms of we're going to do A, B, C, and D, but we're looking towards adaptive management. And adaptive management is the idea that you set a number of goals and objectives and let those lead. What we've done is actually taken a really close look at the species composition in the pit. And so rather than managing for just a couple of species, we're encouraging MR to manage for up to 40 different species. And some species are night migrators, so just leave them alone during the day. You know, some species are divers. And if you've ever looked at a YouTube of an eagle chasing a loon or seen it out on Georgetown Lake, you don't want to push these birds under the water. So let's come up with strategies that work for divers versus dabblers. And it's been working really quite well. We've only been through two seasons, so it's really hard to say definitively with, you know, only two seasons of data.
So what is the plan? What is the mitigation plan to keep the birds out of the water or to get them out of the water as quickly as possible?
So there's deterrents, and deterrents keep them out of the water. That's very hard to do with the size of the pit and the height of the walls. By the time birds decide they're going into the pit, they're going in the pit. The next thing is hazing, and that's getting them up off the water. And that's what I was talking about. And that, you know, sometimes do nothing is a good option because the birds are going to go at night. Nothing that you're going to do during the day is going to get them to move. And then they naturally get up and leave at night. There's no food in the pit, and that's a big motivator. But there's also a lot of activity that we can, or a lot of different technologies we can use to get them to move. Lasers, there's rifle shots, obviously not at the, not towards the birds, but near them. Phoenix whalers that emit sounds, propane cannons. The idea is to scare them and make the pit not a safe place.
And how did you come up with new ways? Because I know that they had certain plans and certain things that they were doing previously. How much better off are we now than before you did your work?
Well, the success rate has always been very, very high. It's always been above 99%. And there's a natural mortality in migration. And so I think that the first thing to recognize is that MR has been doing a fantastic job. In terms of new technologies, our biggest approach is not necessarily new technologies, but how to strategize the technologies that we have with the species. So understanding the species and being, you know, it's really a work smarter, not harder.
Can you go into more specifics on that and, you know, what changed?
Well, sure. So I think one of the biggest things that changed, and this is, you know, a lot of credit goes to Gary Swant for this. He's, again, being an expert birder, trained all of the staff at MR responsible for monitoring the birds on the specific species, because our first question was, we don't know what's out there. We don't really know. When you look at the data sheets, it's literally ducks, ducks, geese, ducks, ducks, geese. And then sometimes you'd get mud ducks, mud hens, green hens. So we don't, you know, we didn't really know. So we needed to get an understanding of what species were out there. And then let's talk about the American coot, right? So this is a diver and this is a night migrator. A bird comes in after flying 200 miles. You know, if you run a marathon or walk up the tiers from the pit, you've got a lot of lactic acid in your muscles. And the last thing you want to do once you've landed and rested is keep on going. So our recommendation is first, just let them be for a little bit. You're going to have more, you know, a better result if you give them a little bit of a break. And so that's changed. Let them rest. Better response time when you do try to haze them. Then look at the species. Now everybody's trained on species identification. If it's an American coot, they're not going to migrate till the evening anyways. So let them rest. Let them have their day. Don't harass them. Don't stress them out. They're going to use up calories that they need to get up off the water. And then other things like coots, loons, grebes, these are all divers, right? So if we are bringing a new technology like a drone, that's going to send them under the water. So that's not a technology you want to use on those species. So really knowing the species is just worlds above in terms of efficacy. But again, I go back to the fact that they were 99% effective, over 99% effective before. So do we close that gap or do we improve this, you know, the actions that we've got?
Mm-hmm. So for business-minded people, why should we be concerned about wildlife management? We could probably talk a whole show about this, but in a nutshell, you know, why is this so important for our community socially, economically, or any community for that matter?
That's a big question. Mm-hmm. You know, human health is intimately tied to environmental conditions. And so even if you don't like wildlife, having wildlife around tells us that we've got an environment that can support life. That's sort of the baseline. People come to, from business-minded, you know, people come to Montana and to Butte and travel all over the world to see wildlife. You know, I've heard the same things when I'm out on the Serengeti in East Africa that I have on, you know, in Yellowstone or in the Bob Marshall. It's a true spectacle, and it's something that we're really fortunate to have. And so being able to make sure that we have an environment that can support wildlife is important for social health, for economic health, for environmental well-being. You know, we don't often put a dollar figure on happiness or enjoyment. And those are some really important factors in where people live and how our environment is put together.
Yeah, and all the dollars that tourism brings in. And at that note, I must say we are out of time.
Well, thank you very much. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks for being here, Stella. And thanks for listening, everybody. This is Heartstock Radio. Bye-bye.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5, Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Friday at 4 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via live stream at butteamericaradio.org.